Welcome to Radio at Firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters. Firehouse.com brings you the leaders of the nation's fire, rescue, and EMS services, the top columnists and educators, and today's most important issues, headlines, and comments. Listen right on your desktop or download and listen on the go to Firehouse.com.
Welcome to the Apparatus Architects with Mike Wilbur and Tom Shand. We are taping this show while we're sitting in Baltimore, Maryland at the annual Firehouse Expo. Going to have a great time this week with several programs put on, but today's rundown is as follows. Brother Mike's going to start us off with some recent events and accidents, including a few very tragic recent incidents happening with personnel responding in their POVs. We've got a plethora. I actually looked that word up there in the dictionary. Got a plethora of questions today we're going to cover with some of the things that our listeners have been writing in. And then we're going to spend a little time before and after the break talking about spec writing, but specifically things that we put in the specs that discourage potential bidders from participating. Sometimes knowingly, sometimes unknowingly, there's little tricks of the trade, so to speak, of things that if you're looking to get several competitive bids, even if you've worked your specs around one favored vendor, there are some things you do that will just absolutely drive the other bidders or suitors crazy that will discourage them from bidding. And a lot of times you get somewhat discouraged on the night of your bid opening when you see there's only one big fat bid package envelope to open, and your attorney or your borough solicitor is looking at you strangely like, how come we're only getting one bid on this? So at any rate, that's what we're going to talk about today. And Brother Mike's going to start us off with some of the things that have been going on here recently in the last couple of weeks.
Good morning. We start off, Brother Tom, with a fatal accident in the state of Ohio, where a firefighter responding on mutual aid in his POV, his personally operated vehicle, not wearing a seatbelt, was responding on a mutual aid to a bowling alley fire. He collided with a civilian auto at an intersection where the driver of that auto sustained debilitating injuries, and her passenger, a male civilian, was not wearing a seatbelt, was ejected and killed. The firefighter responding in his POV, too, was not wearing a seatbelt and suffered debilitating injuries, and it's unclear as we tape this whether he may even survive or not. His injuries are critical. Our thoughts and prayers go out to all involved with that. Also in Pennsylvania, a firefighter from a fire company was killed in the line of duty, and these are in the last week or so. He was 20 years old, was responding in his personal vehicle to a very serious car crash when he crashed. And the firefighter, not again wearing a seatbelt, was ejected from his vehicle and died in the line of duty. He hit a guardrail, causing the truck to travel sideways across both lanes onto another guardrail. After sliding on the guardrail, the truck rolled over before landing upright in the middle of southbound lanes. The crash he was responding to turned out to be a serious crash as well, but the firefighter was not wearing a seatbelt and was ejected from the pickup truck, landing about 15 feet from his vehicle. And again, our thoughts and prayers go out to all concerned in that. Once again, within the last few days, a crash happened in Tazewell County, Virginia, involving a fire apparatus. The apparatus appeared to have lost its brakes on a hill as it was returning from a call. The engine rolled over on its side, trapping the driver and another firefighter inside the truck. The passenger was transported to a local hospital, but the driver had to be flown out by helicopter. The accident's under investigation, and there's no word on any extent of anybody's injuries in that crash. And something that we are doing here at the Expo this week, highlighting overweight apparatus in a program, and overweight apparatus continue to just plague the industry, and many times when apparatus lose their brakes or broken springs or have tire problems, it can be traced back to the weight of the vehicle. And finally, in the you just can't make this stuff up category, we had a firefighter injured over the July 4th weekend when he was on top of a ladder truck along with another firefighter looking for embers, hot embers from a fireworks display. And for whatever reason, this 1995 110-foot ladder was retracted, and four bones in his right foot and one bone in his left foot were fractured. This incident, again, is under investigation. The operator at the time said that he was rotating the ladder to the right, but it's not sure whether there was any mechanical failure or operator error as far as retracting the aerial ladder onto the firefighter's feet and breaking them. What do you think about that, Brother Tom?
Well, Michael, I guess a couple thoughts. Like with the other injuries, any time a brother firefighter gets injured, it's kind of tough to take. In a situation like that where it sounds like they were out doing a, basically a public service, call with respect to the fireworks, I guess if I'm in a department that has an aerial device, an aerial ladder device, and we've talked many times about the advantages, the tactical advantages and disadvantages of an aerial ladder versus an aerial tower or tower ladder. But I guess if your goal was going to be that you're going to have to put somebody on an aerial to act as a spotter of sorts, I would think if I didn't own one, I'd buddy up with a neighboring town that has a tower ladder or something with a bucket on it, no matter what, who made it, and invite them over to catch the fireworks as brother firefighters and put your firefighters or their firefighters in the bucket as compared to having them on the aerial, much less to be having firefighters on an aerial and then be moving it around so that you could put them in a better position to spot the embers. Again, I mean, that's tailor-made for a tower ladder where you could, if we think about some of the ads that some of the manufacturers came out with when they were advertising the physical larger size buckets. I remember vividly on one calendar, they had a picture of like six smiling firefighters in full turnout gear in the bucket of this tower. I don't know how many times you'd ever want to have six firefighters in a bucket, but that might be a time to do it, rather than having a brother exposed out on an aerial device. But you say that sometimes it takes all kinds, and it's maybe unfortunate that something like that will be a learning lesson for that department in the future.
Yeah, thank you, Tom. You just can't make this stuff up. As it relates to two of the crashes this month, obviously it's of grave concern when we have POV operators that are thinking more about going to the emergency run than their own personal safety. And in the cases of the two crashes highlighted here earlier, there are two families that are absolutely suffering now because those firefighters involved were basically selfish. And whether they didn't think that this kind of event would happen to them, or whether they didn't think that they needed seatbelts, or whether they thought that they were invincible, whatever the attitude is, the reality is that one of those firefighters is critically hurt and may not survive, and the other one is dead. And when you kill yourself in this manner, and it's basically kind of a suicide, I mean, you've made a conscious decision not to wear the very safety equipment that's been provided in the car or in the fire truck or whatever you happen to be riding in. You've made a conscious decision not to account for your own personal safety. And we need to get people in this business to take their own personal safety seriously. We need to teach each other and learn from events like this so that we can get people to buckle up. Because at the end of the day, it's the families now and the individual fire departments that are left to clean up this mess. And it could it's certainly going to be a psychological mess. It could even be a financial mess that's going to go on for the weeks, months, and even years to come. When you have a line of duty death like this, and speaking from experience, it doesn't go away in a week. It doesn't go away in a month. It just really never goes away. It gets better over time, but there are a lot of people out there this week hurting because of these two tragic events.
You know, Mike, and just a quick comment on that. When you talked about the personal accountability, I think the other thing is, particularly since you and I, as we're getting older, the other issue becomes for younger firefighters, I think, to become a role model. And sometimes being a role model is difficult in that you look to be the oddball, whether it's, putting your seatbelt on, whether it's not running around on a fire ground, whether it's taking a few extra seconds to make sure your hood's tucked in and your ear flaps are down and all those things that everybody else is looking to want to, like, nudge you into the front door, like, let's go, that the being a role model for other people to observe. And let's go back to that incident you just talked about with the aerial ladder. That article doesn't go on to say, but what's to say that there wasn't, if we take that situation and put it in a different context, where maybe it was in a small town where there was only, like, you know, the big brother fire department had the aerial and the other small departments are there observing the guy on the aerial and the aerial moving and doing all of this, you're kind of almost, from a condescending viewpoint, like saying, hey, this is okay to do because we're out here in the public and somebody else is, another firefighter or the public certainly, is watching you do this, and then the accident happens. And then you say to yourself, wow, that shouldn't happen. Well, if we were a role model and thinking about your own personal safety as one issue, and then, like, if I was going to be putting this on the front page of the newspaper, how would I want this operation or how would I want me to be perceived? You might be thinking of things differently. So it's sometimes taking that big, deep breath and taking a step back, and it's almost like, is this a reasonable and rational thing to do? And if you have to think about it for more than half a second, chances are you probably want to huddle up and maybe rethink about what you're about to get involved in.
Yeah, that's a great point, Tom. And it brings me to a point in my career when you talk about seatbelt usage, and I always get asked the question, do I wear my seatbelt? And yes, I always wear my seatbelt in the fire truck. We have a policy in the FDNY that says to wear seatbelts, but up to this point in time has been kind of enforced, but not really enforced. That's about to all change, and we'll have more on that in a future show. But one thing that occurred to me is, like you said, the best way to lead is to lead by example. So I would consistently get into the truck and put my seatbelt on. And I had a chauffeur by the name of John, and John had 29 years on the job, and I never said anything to him. I never asked him. I never ordered him. But after 4 months of John driving me, I looked over one day, and all of a sudden, this older senior member of the department had a seatbelt on and had never done that before. So you can lead by example. People do watch your actions. Especially the point well taken about the big department surrounded by all the little departments that everybody looks up to you. We have a few questions.
Yeah, we certainly do. And we're going to start off here with one of your favorites here, Mike, from a gentleman. Several times, both of you have described scrub area with aerial devices and the importance of speccing rigs that will allow you to maximize the scrub area. With that in mind, I was surprised to see the cover of the May-June Fire Apparatus Journal with the new FDNY tower ladder sporting a raised roof and a diamond plate equipment box on top of that. Has anyone calculated the loss of scrub area at full extension? I have figured that FDNY probably uses them off the side the majority of the time, so there would be little impact, but I was surprised to see from the most advanced tower ladder users in the world. If that was in this case, using the same cab as the pumpers to simplify maintenance. I was also a little surprised when a tractor-drawn ladder and midship users buy raised roof rigs and then put lights or storage on top of the roofs as well. Maybe I'm just overthinking this issue too much, I'd be curious to hear your thoughts on this matter. Well, Mike, you talk about one that's a softball coming right over the plate to you. How do you what's your comments on that?
This is just really a pet peeve, Tom. If it were up to me and I had control of the industry, I would outlaw all raised roof cabs on fire apparatus.
Oh, Mike, come on. You got cabs where, you know, you got brothers, you got six or eight guys in the back, and you're trying to get dressed going down the road, and, you know you can't stay seated because there's not enough elbow and shoulder room, and you got to have raised roof cabs, right?
Right, yeah. The only reason that people purchase raised roof cabs, for the most part, is to give the green light to firefighters to stand up to get dressed. Many departments have just etched in stone seatbelt policies, and then yet the fire chief signs off on going out and buying raised roof cab apparatus. And subliminally, whether you want to admit it or not, the fire chief now has actually given a green light to allow firefighters to exhibit this behavior. When it comes to aerial devices, and in particular mid-mounted tower ladders, I can't necessarily speak for the Seagrave trucks because I don't know the numbers, but I do know the numbers on a Pierce apparatus. And if you raise the cab roof of an Aero XT chassis, you lose 6 degrees of use. If you leave the roof flat, you can get down to within 11 degrees over the front of the cab. If you raise the cab roof, you can only get down to 17 degrees. And that may not sound much like much to our listeners, but when you're at, say, a hotel or an apartment fire, and you have 60 or 70 feet of boom out, that may be the difference between making a floor and not making a floor out off the front of the trucks. So raised roof cabs and particularly mid-mounted towers, they just don't mix. And raised roof cabs are just a bad idea anyway. They're generally unsafe based on the fact of how they're being used as far as letting people stand up and get dressed in them.
Well, Mike, and I think the other thing that inherent in the gentleman's question was with respect to, you already have a raised roof, and again, to our listeners, depending on what make and model of cab and chassis you have, you can go from as little as 6 inches of raised roof up to, as I've seen them, as high as 24 inches, although you typically wouldn't see that on a tower. But it then almost compounds the issue on any mid-mount aerial device where you've already got the raised roof, and then you decide you're going to put a light tower on the rig, and you slam the light tower on top of the raised roof. Now that reduces your scrub area off the front even more.
Absolutely, Tom. Absolutely. Just a bad idea altogether.
Okay. Well, looks like you got a guy on first base on that one. So here's the second pitch of the game. Brother Mike, I'll soon be delivering a canned emergency vehicle operator program for my career department for both fire and EMS personnel. I've tried through several sources to retrieve accurate statistical data on crashes, injuries, fatalities, locations, and collision types, but specific to the emergency services. I was wondering if you have a reference for me, and would you share that as to where I might find this information? So far, I've looked in several areas, but haven't found anything in the area specific to emergency vehicles. So, Mike, you being the knower of all technical data with respect to emergency vehicle operations, what's your experience in that area?
Tom, it's quite simple. There are no statistics, and they just simply don't exist. The only data that's kept track of as it relates to vehicle accident are line-of-duty deaths by the NFPA, the National Fallen Firefighters, and the U.S. Fire Administration, who actually count line-of-duty deaths differently. Hard to believe, but that's true. They have different criteria, each group, for how they account. But in any event, if you get involved in a fatal crash like the one that we just highlighted, that particular individual is going to be listed as a line of duty death. And that's it. There are some injuries. There are some injuries out there that are kept track of when there's a really bad accident that may be highlighted in an annual report or something like that. But the reality is that there's nobody keeping statistical data with the exception of perhaps the insurance industry. And when it comes to the fire truck insurance industry, there are a couple of big companies, notably VFIS, Volunteer Fireman Insurance Services, and ESIP, Emergency Services Insurance Program, that do any number of trucks, but yet they don't do them all. There are some fleets that are insured by big municipal city concerns that insure not only fire trucks, but garbage trucks and snowplow trucks and everything else in the city fleet. So that's one part of the story. I was invited to serve on a couple of committees, Tom, by the U.S. Fire Administration as it relates to emergency vehicle operations. And one of them, one of the books that was produced by our committee was The Safe Operation of Fire Department Tankers. You can access that on the USFA website. And the other one was The Safe Operation of Emergency Vehicles. And the very first recommendation that the committees made in both of those books was to get some kind of reporting system to gather data. We know we have a driving problem. We know we kill a bunch of civilians each year. We know we kill firefighters and injure them each year, and we wreck a lot of trucks, but nobody has all that data in one place. And so one of our recommendations was to urge the USFA or other groups to pony up some money, perhaps the DOT, to make this data collection a reality so that we could the best way to fix a problem is first to define the scope and depth of that problem, and we're just not there yet. And a funny aside to this, I got contacted by a fella from USA Today magazine, newspaper, by the name of Doug Pardue, and I told him that there was no statistical data available because he was doing a story on line of duty deaths in the fire service, and he said, "Oh, I'll find it. Don't you worry. It's got to be out there somewhere. I'll find it." I said, "I've been doing this a long time, and I'm telling you, there's no statistical data available." Well, Doug called me up about 10 days later and said, "I can't believe it. In this day of computers and information gathering, you're absolutely right. There is no data."
Well, I'll appreciate that, Mike. Yeah, it's some things you find out that you can go into the Google or another search engine and throw in a couple of words and come up with 15 or 20 resources on stuff. And here's one where we could have the data that could work for us, and it's not there. Okay, the third one here at the inning for you. This came from a captain from a department in upstate New York saying, "I'm working on developing a driver training skills course for my department using the NFPA 10,002 guideline. This section states that the serpentine portion of the cone course should be about 30 to 38 feet apart, depending on the wheelbase. And he says, I couldn't find anything that expresses an equation or value of the relationship, whether you've got smaller or longer vehicles. And in this particular department, their engines were about 30 feet in length, and then they had a mid-mount tower ladder that was about 48 feet in length. So how do you adjust the serpentine portion of the course, Mike, when you're going to put drivers through that, when you got a real short wheelbase wagon and then you've got some monster tandem axle tower?"
That's a really great question, Tom. And when emergency vehicle response is out on the road doing driving classes, we fight this all the time, this kind of condition. And generally, what my people do that handle the driving, that they, if they have an aerial device that's a lot bigger than the engines, they will measure the device from bumper to rear, most part of the apparatus, and then they add 6 feet in between the cones, and that generally suffices. The problem with that then is if you have short wheelbase engines that you're running through the same course at the same time, it becomes not much of a challenge, and it's pretty much a bunt getting the smaller stuff in. Sometimes what we'll do, in the case of the last course that we ran several weeks ago, we had the engines go through first, and then we adjusted the course for the truck. And then, of course, we go and do it as a profession. Sometimes what we'll do is that we'll paint where the cones go, and we'll adjust the cones when the truck is on the course, and then readjust them back for the smaller engine apparatus to make it a challenge for those folks as well. And as far as some kind of mathematical formula, I haven't run across one. It just says in all the literature that distance between the cones and the serpentines needs to be between 30 and 38 feet. 38 feet obviously being for the larger trucks. So that's how we handle that particular situation when we go out and give the driving class.
All right, Michael, I understand you got a couple for me here. Let's see how I do.
Okay, Brother Tom, I have read a number of stories or heard discussions that looked at sending a pickup truck or an SUV versus an engine or a smaller vehicle, etc. My father's department is in a suburban rural setting, purchased a four-man cab pickup, mounted a rescue body and a 200-gallon tank with a 750-gallon pump. They use the rig for the following: EMS responses, brush fires, wires down, service calls, mutual aid when a full-size rig is not needed, etc. It's got a full complement of firefighting gear, hoses, tools, and SCBA, and can be utilized for a number of responses.
Well, I guess on that, I mean, we're getting into some areas where it's more discretionary with respect to how departments want to operate. But I guess just first a few thoughts. Even prior to the downturn in the economy, where a lot of departments' maintenance budgets are currently being squeezed, and replacement costs for apparatus, while they're continuing to increase, departments don't have a whole lot of capital monies available for apparatus, that they found out that running, for example, a full-size engine or a ladder truck or a quint on every run first out the door, particularly in jurisdictions where the majority of your runs are medical runs, yeah, you're providing the service and delivering it, but I guess going back to a tagline that Alan Bruancini used a number of years ago, are we using concrete mixers to deliver pizza pies? Yeah, you're doing it, but you're doing it at a pretty significant cost, and you're, in a lot of cases, you're shortening the life expectancy of your full-size apparatus. So there's one perspective. The other one would be, and on any type, in this case, a gentleman asked specifically about a pickup. All right, a pickup, any one of these other light-duty chassis, one of the most common issues that you find when people outfit them and after they've run for a while with all the stuff that they've accumulated is that very frequently they're overweight. In some cases, they can be underpowered, particularly if it was a hand-me-down rig. But even if the unit was purchased new, I mean, give two extremes. The city of Syracuse, New York, which I'm very familiar with, which really pioneered the use of mini pumpers starting back in 1971, still today runs, and the unit's dispatched as a mini pumper, and it runs out with two personnel, and it is used basically as a EMS first response vehicle. All right, it has, other than a water can, has no pump or tank. All right, it was not intended to fight fire, as the department's programs have evolved over the course of years. But it has saved wear and tear on the larger pumpers, which are full-size engines, the majority of which, you know, are equipped with multiple attack lines and 50-foot telescopic water towers. So the mini pumper can run frontline for 3 to 4 or 5 years. They buy them with composite bodies, which is another smart thing to do. You can transfer the body over into another cab or chassis as long as during the course of the time that they haven't adjusted the cab to axle or the axle width on you. And it's a very economical way to deliver the service without running a $500,000 fire truck up and down the road all the time. The other issue that becomes that's not necessarily written into this gentleman's question is that, say, okay, you've got a cab capable of carrying potentially four personnel, assuming there's four personnel available for response, and a 200-gallon water tank. All right, if you're going out to Wires Down or a brush fire and you're strictly limiting to that where you might have to use some suppression capabilities, I guess you're okay. But at some point in time, administrations could change or, you know, people over above the fire chief would say, well, you're running something like that. Why don't we just let's buy those for the department? And clearly 200 gallons of water is enough to get you in trouble if you're going to start using it for anything beyond these minor type of incidents. So it's not necessarily a bad idea, but you have to kind of fit it into the overall program. It's certainly not designed to replace a full-size piece of apparatus, but if it's a supplemental unit designed to take the load off, you know, the full-size rigs, you can. It's certainly easier to maintain. If you can staff it properly to do what you want to do with it, then not necessarily a bad idea. Several people to finish up on that one, Mike, have thought that maybe there would be a resurgence of mini pumper or these small quick attack type vehicles, and you have seen some departments kind of swing back to the way they were 25 or 30 years ago. The issues with those units still are, and as we have experienced firsthand, they can pretty easily become overloaded if you don't spec them properly. You know, if you buy your chassis from, you know, Bucky Nut Welders, you know, International GMC Ford Dodge dealership, and then Bucky sends it out to your favorite fire truck builder, there's a reasonable chance you might be going down a wrong road. Not all the time, but more often than not, we found out that these units, once you get them outfitted and you don't initially think or plan out how you're going to use those, it starts out with, well, we're going to put a little bit of equipment on it. Then you put more equipment on it, and then you start filling up the compartments. And the way these rigs are designed now, you've got more compartment space in many cases than what you've got the GVW carrying capacity to load all this stuff up. So need to do it with a little bit of caution.
Great. Great, Tom. Thank you for that. Just a couple more questions, and this is right up your alley. Talk about getting a home run pitched for somebody that had worked for ISO for a number of years. Certainly these next several questions will be right up your alley. The first one, though, is if we refurb a rig, does it have to come up to NFPA standards? And is there a threshold dollar amount to require it?
Okay, good question. Within the NFPA refurbishing standard, there's a level one and a level two refurbishment. In the one refurbishment, when you are attempting then to bring the unit up to the current NFPA standards, which given the 2009 standard, understand may be somewhat difficult to do even if your rig was 5 to 8 years old. Typically, you'd be refurbing units that are older than that. But understand that now, because of some of the technology that you have in terms of the event data recorder and the seatbelt monitoring and things like that, while all that stuff is good, you may find that electronically it's impossible to do it on your vehicle without changing out major parts of the electrical system or the electrical harness in total, which may be difficult, if not prohibitive, to do. The other level of refurbishment allows you to bring to enhance the safety of the unit. Certainly, there are other aspects of the current 1901 standard with respect. Let's say you got a 1994 vintage unit. You could certainly upgrade it with respect to increasing the reflectivity of the unit through chevrons on the back, Scotch light and reflective material on the side and the front, upgrading of warning lights, replacing older valves with slow close valves and things like that. And that is typically more the way I think you're going to see people do it, only because it's going to be pretty difficult to upgrade a unit to the current 2009 standard 100% across the board. Is there a dollar threshold limit? No, there's nothing in the standard to that. The old rule of thumb, which you need to kind of modify a little bit, was if you started to approach 50% of the cost of a new rig, it maybe refurbishing was not valid. That may be, that statement was probably more truth to that back 5 to 8 years ago, before we had this explosion in the cost of raw materials and with engine changes and so forth. So now you look at, let's take, for example, a pumper. And if you're going to spec out a custom pumper with a big body pump 1500 GPM or greater, 750-gallon water tank, particularly if it's going to be the high horsepower engine, greater than 450 horse, where you've got the 4000 series transmission, and you start doing all of those things. Almost the entry-level price for rigs like that are well north of $400,000, and it's not uncommon at all to see people spend $500,000 on a fire truck. To show how old I am, I remember the first time I heard about a $40,000 fire truck, and I drove 2 hours back in the early 70s because I wanted to see what the hell somebody spent $40,000 on. Now you spend $40,000 for the engine and a part of the transmission in a crate, and that's all you get. So if you needed to expense, for example, in that scenario, your local dealer quotes you, let's say, $510,000 for this pumper that you want to spec out with a nominal amount of equipment, and you're looking at a major refurbishment to upgrade the unit, well, you say for $250,000, you can do a lot. Now, you're not going to do a glider kit take off a two-door cab and put on a four-door cab with new body work for all of that. But you need to temper that a little bit to saying, rather than saying, if I'm at 49%, I'm okay, but if I'm at 52%, I'm not good. I think you need to look at, say, what's the cost difference or the cost avoidance between what you're trying to accomplish on the refurb project and how much longer you're going to anticipate to run that vehicle, most importantly, versus what the cost of a new vehicle is. And this is even more important, Mike, when you get up into the stuff of your expertise in ladder trucks. If you're looking at a new mid-mount tower ladder and your local dealer quotes you up $1.1 million and you can remount your existing tower on a new cab and chassis and bring it up to current day standards and do it for $700,000, well, that's certainly more than 50%, but you've just had a cost avoidance of $400,000. So I think you can use these figures as a selling point to your community to show them what you're trying to accomplish, as long as you're going to get the life expectancy out of the rebuilt unit. So there's nothing, and again, if you talk to different people, I'd say Mike and I are pretty stalwart in our opinions about this. If you talk to two other people about refurbing, they might give you a completely different story. And understand, when you talk to a potential vendor, I mean, he could look at if you're running a 1962 F model Ford with a body that, you know, built by a company that's been out of business for 30 years. He'll say, oh, yeah, hell yeah, we can, you know, we can remount that body on a new cab and chassis. I mean, the vendors are going to certainly typically not discourage you from doing this. And that's why you need to get outside help in this to make sure if you're going to, when you get to the fork in the road, as Yogi Berra would say, take it. You got to make sure you take the right fork in the road.
Yeah, I think one of the things that we've learned over time, what is a refurbishment? What is a rehab? And that goes from anything as little as going to Earl Shives for a $99.95 paint job, all the way up to a full glider kit and everything in between. So it's very difficult a lot of days to define, you know, what a rehab is. What do you want to accomplish, and how much life expectancy do you want to get out of the apparatus? Some of the rules I think that we could both agree on, and we have over time, is there has to be some kind of price break there, where at some point you're just chasing good money after bad. Some of the rules that I like, and we'll see if Brother Tom agrees or not. If the apparatus has already been substantially rehabbed before, I mean, how many Band-Aids are you going to put on a cut that really needs stitches and you're hemorrhaging?
Typically, if the unit's already had some significant work, you got to look at, okay, what's going wrong with the unit now? It's probably, past its time to think about just throwing more money into the money pit.
Yeah. Then the next point to be made is, if the apparatus is no longer being manufactured, I think you were involved, or you knew of a department in downstate New York that took a water chief that American LaFrance stopped making, I think, in the late 80s. This is now in the early 2000s, and invested a lot of money in that truck. And you know, there's no assurance that you're even going to get parts for it.
Yeah, I mean, you want to look at the vintage of the unit, certainly. You want to look at who built it and are parts available. I mean, things as inconsequential as windshields. And for example, I had somebody call me the other day and was wanting to know where I thought for a particular make and model of unit, where they could get, you know, windshield wiper motors. All right. Because even though the company was still in business, they said, well, geez, we haven't used that vendor in 8 years. You know, we can't really help you. And they weren't able easily to give them a cross-reference part to say, as it turned out, they went down to the local Napa store, and after a couple days of investigation, you know, they were able to help them out. But, I mean, it can be small little things like that. We're not talking about the big firefighting parts that can just drive you absolutely nuts if you can't get access to those parts.
And then the third reason a lot of times is that depending on what the truck was when it was originally new, a lot of times, particularly with commercial style rigs, they were kind of built as inexpensive kind of throwaway rigs that weren't necessarily built to last over 20 years. Would you find that to be true?
Yeah. I mean, again, you have to look at what, you know, how much, you know, what you buy the rig for originally, you know, on commercial cab chassis apparatus, certainly it was cost less than a custom. There may be times you may be tempted just to, as you said, throw a Band-Aid at it. So let's, you know, that's how much money. What you don't want to do with any kind of refurbishment is just look at, so, well, here's how much money I've got, and then clearly we don't have enough for a new rig, so we're just going to expense that and throw some money at this and hope for the best. That's, in more often than not, 9 out of 10 times, 4 out of 5 dentists would say, not a good idea. You're just throwing, you know, good money after bad.
How many times have you seen in, like, Fire Apparatus Magazine or some of the other monthly periodicals that sell apparatus where a unit was, they'll advertise it as it was completely refurbed in 2007 and now it's for sale in 2010?
Yeah, that alone tells you something. If you're going to do any kind of any degree of refurbishing, no matter how limited it is, you at least want to get 4 to 5 years out of the project. We'll wrap up with this comment. All right, back in 1990, and this is, I think, the two very, very good examples. Back in 1990, the U.S. Marine Corps took delivery of 11 very well built and designed Pierce walk-in rescue trucks, and one of those, one or two. Two went to several of the larger bases across, but every Marine Corps base in the United States took delivery of one of these, and they were brand new, very well done. Over a period of years, like most rescue trucks, they didn't wear out, but the amount of stuff they wanted to carry increased, and they found that the walk-in portion of the body really wasn't necessary. So the majority of these rigs, several over the course of each year, were sent back to Pierce and rebuilt with brand new non-walk-in roll-up store bodies to give them increased compartment space, and with the thought that the Marine Corps would be able to get an additional, in some cases, 5 to 7 years out of that. Now, for the cost they had into the vehicle originally, and for the life expectancy that they got, they operated from 1990. I think the first one of these they did around 2004, 2005. They're going to be able to run these rigs for 20 years plus and enhance the operation and safety of the vehicle, right? The Army, because of the hostilities going on in different parts of the world, right, their budget for new fire apparatus had dropped off dramatically. Mike and I taught out in Fort Hood, Texas, and as well as a couple of other Army bases that we visited, that the Army is going to do in glider kit rebuilds, that they take the engine transmission, sometimes the rear axle and fire pump, out of existing vehicles and put them in brand new apparatus built by several manufacturers, where everything then is brand new, and it's built to the current NFPA standard. All right, and they fully expect that with the life cycle that the Army's going to get, that they're going to be able to run for a good number of years. That's like the appropriate way to do it. When you just have a little bit of money in your pocket and you think like, well, I think we want to solve an initial problem, That's probably not the best thing to do. Mike, you had mentioned that this gentleman had a couple questions with respect to ISO.
Yes, Brother Tom. Can we get the same ISO credit by using automatic aid? And then I have a follow-up that many of our listeners might not discern. What is the difference between automatic aid and mutual aid?
All right. In ISO's eyes right now, although their standards are in the process of being looked at, but in the fire suppression rating schedule that's been out there for a number of years, Automatic aid implies that if Mike and I are in neighboring jurisdictions and fire departments and I get a incident in my jurisdiction, that Brother Mike's department is alerted automatically and or simultaneously with the initial alert, all right? It's not, all right, that's automatic aid, where it's done as rapidly as the communication system allows it to happen. It is not the situation where my department is alerted, I roll out, and at some point, either en route or after I get there, then recognize I need help and call for that. That's mutual aid, and that's fine, but that's not going to be looked at by ISO in the same vein. Also in the fire suppression rating schedule, although this might change in the future, there is a limitation saying that in order for automatic aid to get credit of the apparatus and staffing coming in, it had to be within 5 miles of the location that you were talking about. So you certainly not to discourage the fact that you don't need automatic aid. If your automatic aid is more than 5 miles away, that's even more important to get them coming because of the distances and the time travel involved. But for ISO's purposes, the 5 mile limitation exists. And where you're on common communication systems and all of that stuff, it just lends itself all that much more to that. So with that, we're going to take a break. It's Mike Wilbur and Tom Shan, the Apparatus Architects. We'll be right back.
Radio at firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters.
Okay, welcome. We're back. Mike Wilbur, Tom Shan, taping live from Baltimore, Maryland, actually sitting in the 9th floor of a unnamed, undisclosed location, so you cannot find us. But we're looking over the beautiful Camden Yards, home of the Baltimore Orioles. So, hey, one other quick gratuitous plug. The Apparatus Architect podcast that we're going to tape later on this week with some of the notables from the apparatus industry will be up and available on September 7th. So we're going to be doing that with four or five folks that have helped us out in years past, where we're going to be talking about industry and apparatus issues and getting the upfront, close, and personal information from the people that make it happen every day of the week. We're going to be taping that later on this week, and that will be up and available for our listeners on September 7th. So, Michael said you got the...
I got one more to go, yep.
Okay, here we go. Going to try to lay down a bunt and advance the runner.
There it is. Is there still an ISO requirement to be able to deliver water 100 feet off the ground?
Okay. First, not being trite, that there's not really any specific requirement for that. The ISO requirement with respect to aerial devices, and believe me, it pains me greatly to have to talk about that. All right. But since we got the water delivery in there, that's calming me down a little bit, Mike. If you have five buildings, three stories or greater in height, and again, this is current information in the fire suppression rating schedule, may or may not change in some of the new criteria that ISO's in the process of developing. But if you have five buildings, three stories or greater in height, then you require an aerial device. Then that doesn't necessarily mean you have to get a 100-foot device. It just means you need to have an aerial device to be able to get up to the uppermost inhabited story of those three-story structures. Let's assume for the moment, though, that you have buildings that are higher than that. Well, because there's a practical limitation of aerial devices, which ISO considers to be 100 feet. Now, we all know that from a spec standpoint, and we'll be getting into that in a second, you know, somebody makes a 102, somebody makes a 105, there's a 107, there's a 121, and I think the highest U.S.-made aerial device, I believe I'm correct in this statement, currently is manufactured at 125 feet. ISO does not come in and differentiate the difference in the and aerial devices. It can be a platform, an articulating platform. It can be a tower ladder, an aerial tower, any kind of aerial device. They don't give more or less credit for one or the other. And if you had buildings that required you to have a 100-foot device, if you had 7 or 8-story buildings, that's the maximum height device that they can require. With that, they give you points of credit if you have an elevated stream. So if you only had 3-story buildings and could reach the uppermost stories with a 75-foot aerial device and had either through a pre-pipe waterway or a conventional ladder pipe an ability to develop an elevated stream, that's satisfactory. So that they don't differentiate between the different heights, and they don't specifically have a requirement. For example, let's suppose you had all just big box stores and strip malls in your first two area, and typical 1 and 2 story row frames. You wouldn't necessarily have to have an aerial device. They then wouldn't, in and of itself, require that you have an elevated water stream, you know, with few exceptions. So there's the answer to that. All right, we're going to get into our final topic here to wrap up today's podcast. Talk a little bit about, and I guess this has been because of some of the work that Mike and I have done within probably in the last 3 to 4 months. I've done a lot of specification reviews for folks where they have written the spec around a particular vendor, and it's the one that they preferred, not surprisingly. But they are looking, because of either political pressure or because of wishes within the fire department, to get more than just one bid, that bid being the person that they've worked with, that they prepared the specs with. So they're looking for what can we do to, quote, open up the spec to make sure that we get several other bidders to supply their product. So with that, there are some things that, from my casual observation, that I've seen that can either encourage or discourage potential bidders, because most of the people that are in the industry, let's lay the cards on the table here. If they've written their spec around product A, and we're not validating whether product A is good, bad, or indifferent, but if they've written their specs around product A or B, most everybody else in the industry can read that spec and pretty reasonably identify whose spec or what the preferred product is based on how the spec was developed, all right, from a technical perspective. So one of the first things that can happen is in the requirements to bidders or the boilerplate. Sometimes departments in major communities, they write their own boilerplate spec. You go major cities where Michael, FDNY, has very extensive, very detailed boilerplate. Other cities whose specs I'm familiar with, they have their own standard boilerplate, which incorporates the fire department requirements together with purchasing requirements, and that stuff's pretty straightforward, all right? The boilerplate, if you got your spec written by manufacturers A, and he gives you his boilerplate, chances are there's a lot of stuff in that boilerplate, although it seems inconsequential, Mike, that stuff lends itself to wanting to deal with that vendor. And again, we're not saying these are good, bad, or indifferent, plus or minus, but examples can be having a requirement for a service facility within X number of miles of the fire department. Obviously, you want to have service, and you're going to have to go somewhere. We reviewed a spec a couple of weeks back where this requirement for the service facility, and it listed all the criteria that the service facility had to be within 15 miles of the community. Well, you know, if you had to take that one to court, the late Johnny Cochran might want to call you on that one. You know, that might be tough to justify. And again, we're not saying it's good, bad, or indifferent, but these are things that if you get it down that tight as compared to saying you have to have one, you know, within the state or one within 100 or 150 miles or some reasonable and rational distance. But when you have these numbers that are cranked down to small, finite things. Another one is that was very common and used for a while was the amount of liability insurance that a manufacturer had to carry. Now, it's pretty obvious that if Mike and I are competing companies, and I'm one of the big two or big three, and Mike's running the mom-and-pop shop where his insurance vendor is the family friend down the street that's always insured the Wilbers, you know, for all these years and has the Wilbur home insurance and the fire insurance and all the Wilburettes and their auto insurance, chances are, you know, Mike's not going to have $10 million worth of liability insurance. And we've seen that come up in specs, and people then try to utilize that or rationalize why then if the Wilbur fire apparatus bids my project and he's got $5 million of liability insurance, I attempt to throw him out saying, well, you don't have the proper amount of liability insurance. Again, kind of take that for what it's worth, but for some of the smaller vendors for a while, they looked at that and saying, by you almost advertising, you got X number of million dollars of liability insurance. It's almost like, fall off my fire truck so I can sue you. I mean, it's almost like, you know, innocuous advertising. So, you know, something like that.
Suppose I like three different fire truck manufacturer specs, and I want to take my computer and cut and paste, and I want the best of all three of those specs. How many people am I going to get to bid on my project?
Well, you'll probably get all three of those guys then either taking a whole bunch of exceptions, Mike, or what typically has happened, and this is where we're leading. This is where we're leading to. That once you get beyond the boilerplate issues, you get into the technical spec. Most of the 9 to 10 manufacturers that build their own cab and chassis, and we're talking for the moment now to the listeners, custom cab and chassis, and understand that you can write a spec for a Navistar, a Kenworth, a Peterbilt, a Freightliner, a Ford, any one of the other manufacturers that build a Mack, that build a commercial cab and chassis that could be used in a bunch of different vocations. The length of that chassis specification typically runs somewhere between maybe 5 to 10 pages. And if you put out a spec for a Navistar 7400 4x4 four-door cab and chassis, whether you're Wilbur Fire Apparatus, Shand Fire Apparatus, or whomever, that cab and chassis is available to everybody. Everybody might not pay the same price, but the componentry needs to all be the same. And there's little that can be put into that spec to make it proprietary. And most communities, most solicitors wouldn't have a problem if you are trying to standardize on a certain brand of commercial cab and chassis for your smaller vehicles or potentially maybe your frontline units as well, because those cabs and chassis are available to everybody. It's not that I can get one, but Mike can't, right? When you get into the world of custom cab and chassis, the way that the rules of engagement are, so to speak, or have developed over the years, is the specification covering that custom cab and chassis, instead of being 5 to 10 pages in length, can range anywhere from, I've seen them, 30 upwards of 40-plus pages of 100 to 100-plus pages of total specifications. Almost half the spec is devoted to the cab and chassis. So what happens if you write your specification solidly around chassis A, if I am one of the other vendors that's going to bid, and you tell me I had the need to take exception and clarification to everything where my product differs from the product that you've specified, and it's worthwhile to put the comment in there, I cannot just take total exception to the spec and say, I'm taking total exception, everything you said, here's my spec, read it and figure it out. That's inappropriate as well. But the way most of the level of technical expertise that's written into the custom cabs and chassis, literally by the time you get into page 10 of that 40 to 50 pages of custom chassis, if I'm going to be honest with you and tell you every place where my cab and chassis is different, be it, you know, I have a two-piece windshield, not a single-piece windshield, my windshield is 2,872 square inches, not 2,950 square inches. I have a slightly different dimension in my cab step area. I have full-height stainless steel panels inside my cab doors where your spec asks for scuff plates on the bottom and an ABS vacuum-formed upper with a map storage area. It gets to the point that you could end up having 50 to 60 exceptions just in the cab and chassis area. So what we think might be a better approach, all right, is to identify what cabs and chassis are acceptable to your department. And if you have looked beyond just the one vendor you're interested in, or you've looked at what's available in the field, identify by make and model, I want manufacturer's A chassis, his model version 2.3. All right, I will accept manufacturer's B's chassis, his version, his make and model. And if you're going to have the same engine and transmission, and to a point axles, all right, then the manufacturers don't have to delineate all of the differences between the cab step areas. You should be familiar with those, and the amount of the windshield space and the height inside the cabs and that. All that stuff's important. But it does encourage bidders rather than discourage bidders to offer a competitive bid. And what our experience has been, particularly the way the economic climate is right now, is that the competing vendors, let's say in this case you've written your spec around manufacturer C, but during the specification development process, you met with manufacturer A and B as well. So the day that the specs hit the street and the legal notice is in the newspaper, all three manufacturers hustle down to the village hall, the city hall, your solicitor, and they pick up the specs. And by the time manufacturer A and B get into their vehicles, they've looked at them and go, damn, they wrote their specs around, you know, manufacturer C. So right away, you've got a disconnect. Well, maybe even though you talk to those people, they're going to say, well, I'm not going to waste my time. For the listeners, understand, to put a competitive bid together, no matter how your specs were developed, you're talking several days of work and hundreds, if not thousands of dollars to prepare the bid, particularly if the bid requires that you supply detailed drawings with the bid and all this material we recognize is important and should be required, a turning radius diagram, an electrical load analysis, a weight analysis of the vehicle as proposed. If you're buying the vehicle with a lot of loose equipment that's above and beyond what the manufacturer would supply, all of that stuff's got to be priced out. People have to procure and gather that information, get their bid bond, and put all this material together in that big 3 or 4 inch three ring binder that you're going to open up the day of the bid opening. And unless you have delineated more clearly what your requirements are, if you just want to get one bid and not interested in, quote, a competitive bid, then frankly, don't be surprised if you write your spec around one vendor and nobody else shows up. And that may or may not be in your favor.
That seems to happen all the time. We have a department, Tom, right, that has a firehouse full of brand A. They write a spec around brand A, and then they call us up and say, geez, I can't understand why nobody from brand B, C, and D bid.
Well, exactly, Mike. Even given the competitive nature, all right, if you've got all of one brand, we're not saying that that's wrong, and there's something to be said for standardization. But if your bidding process is going to come under review, if you get your funding through public sources, all right, at some point, maybe you haven't experienced this in the past, your bidding process or the number of bids or the price range of the bids might come under scrutiny, and you're going to need to be in the position to justify and validate why you want to buy something rather than just saying, this is what we want, so you guys need to pony up the extra money. And it kind of comes around to this point. Because of all of my years of experience in the apparatus industry, I was brought up under the guise that if what I'm offering is different, whether I think it's better or not, is immaterial. If it's different than what you've asked for in your spec, I owe it to you, the user, to define that in either an exception or clarification and say, here's what you've asked for, here's what I'm offering, and here's why it's either different and or better, if I really think it's better, and let you make the judgment. What we find happening more often than not is that other bidders that are going to offer something up against what you've asked for will put in a certain number of exceptions or clarifications. And while they're different, we could do a whole show on, in my, you know, world of pink, what the difference is between an exception and clarification. Over the course of years, that's kind of gotten muddled. But people will write a certain number of exceptions through the bid, and about a third of the way or halfway through, they frankly just, the heck with this, all right? We just did one recently where the one bidder took like 13 clarifications, exceptions to the cab and chassis, but when they got into the body portion, they only took 3 for the whole rest of the spec, and we found 20 plus things that he should have taken exceptions or clarifications to. So I don't know whether he ran out of time, got tired, didn't read the spec, or whatever. But for example, if you're asking for a particular performance on a foam system, no matter who builds the foam system, if you don't build your own and you're going to buy another vendor's component, and they're saying, I want this system to develop, for example, using 3% foam, want to be able to develop 400 gallons per minute, all right, in finished foam solution at 3%, and you bid a system that supplies like 125 GPM, well, that's a difference. 125 is not 400. I don't care how you cut the cheese here, no matter who makes the system, whether you make it or you're buying it. an item like that needs to be clarified. And this particular vendor, they were silent on it. They didn't say anything about the foam system, all right? We identified that in our technical review and analysis of the bid. But you find that the people just, they get certain point in and just say, okay, that's it. Here's my price. And in a lot of cases, no disrespect to other people, you know, some of the other, you know, any manufacturer, but they will just offer whatever and kind of let price be the guide, all right? So there are things to, one of the things you want to be specific on, and Mike and I feel very strong about this, and then hold to your guns to say that anything that you offer, in addition to the fact you can't take general exception to our whole spec, all right, is to define the differences between what you're offering and what we're asking for. So if it's, you've got a different size tire, a different brand tire, you've got a different size or brand of alternator, you're bidding a different kind of electrical system, all right? Well, in addition to having the electrical load analysis to back up that what you're bidding is going to work, all right, because we're not going to buy it and then find out it doesn't work, take exception and or clarification to each and every one of those items, all right? Unfortunately, that has gotten so far back in the wayside that people write a certain number, whatever they want, and then they just throw their hands up and say, okay, now the onus is on the user, the municipality buying the vehicle. And I don't think, Mike, we've done a bid review for a community yet in the last year where there hasn't been, where there has been two, three, or more bidders where the price spread, and we're talking about all kinds of different products here, ladies and gentlemen. It's we're not just talking pickups and mini pumpers and things. We haven't done a bid yet where there's been less than $45,000 to $50,000 price spread, high to low.
Let me ask you a question, and that just brings a question to me that I actually don't know the answer to. What would be, comparing apples to apples now, what would be an acceptable price spread? And then once you get over that price spread, you realize that it's no longer apples to apples, that somebody is offering a change in your specification that is less than what you would ask for.
That's a good question. And again, this is, we're shooting from the hip now. Kind of goes back to the listeners that have been listening to the whole podcast. This goes back to some of the apparatus accident statistics. These statistics don't exist. You can't read this in a book. My experience, industry experience, has been if there is typically more than 2 to 3% difference in the total bid, a 2 to 3% difference between reputable vendors, let's suppose you got six vendors, all right? Part of the old adage was you throw out the high, you throw out the low, and you deal with somebody in the middle. I don't necessarily subscribe to that. But if there were qualified vendors that have met your other requirements, your bidding requirements, that have put together the supporting material to allow you to evaluate it, if their spread of their bids is between 2 to 3%, that's pretty close. So let's take our $500,000 fire truck, okay? If that's the case, and there's a spread of $10,000 to $15,000.
That's pretty legitimate, though.
Pretty legit. It's just, it's different construction techniques. It could be go back to the foam system. You make a foam system, I buy the foam system. So if you make the foam system, Mike, in your plant, you're one of the heavy hitters. You control the cost of that. I buy the foam system from somebody else. I don't control the cost of that. That comes into my loading dock as an item, and it's part of the equipment that I'm going to buy in the components, and I need to mark that up a little bit so I can make a little money on that. So when all those kinds of things add up. If you're in the area of tires, all right, we're all going to either put typically Mission or Goodyear tires on there. Maybe even a better example is engines, okay? I can have the same model of engine that you're offering in your spec, but if you build 800 rigs a year and I build 80, all right, this is where these two dynamics can come into conflict, all right? Some people will say, let's buy the Shan fire truck because he only builds 80, so that means he's got to pay more attention to detail because you're building 800. That means you're building in a month slightly less than what I build all year, so I got to have better customer service. Well, that may or may not be the case, all right? If I'm buying an engine and you're buying an engine, and of your 800 rigs, 600 of them are custom chassis, and you're buying 600 engines a year, and I'm buying 60 a year, you tell me who you think's going to get the better price on the engine.
Absolutely.
All right? It's unlike going down, you know, the food aisle in the shopping, and you're going to buy a head of lettuce, and whether you buy one head of lettuce or five, it's the same price, all right? But because our United States economy is driven by people making money, right, the guy that builds more rigs, that uses more of the components, typically is going to have a couple of percentage points advantage on some of his component costs. It just is the nature of the beast. So, you know, to kind of wrap up here, again, at some point in the future, if we have any listeners that have questions on this particular topic.
I just have
topic,
one right now. Just okay. Came in online just for you, Mr. Shan. A question from one of our listeners on a computer as we speak. And the question is there a current crash test standard for fire apparatus that you would recommend for our spec?
All right. The current crash test is basically is a European standard that everyone utilizes now. There is a single facility that I'm aware of that you well know of, Mike, that does the crash testing of the cabs for all of the people that build custom chassis fire apparatus. Depending upon what manufacturer you are considering, they will have probably somewhere from half a page to maybe three quarters of a page of details of the documentation of their crash testing that their cab undergoes. That crash testing is done by an independent agency, all right? So if we want to put a parallel to this, it's just like saying you could put a simple statement. I want to have my completed pumper, all right, tested and certified by Underwriters Laboratories upon completion, but prior to delivery into my community, and then after delivery, but prior to acceptance, we're going to do a 40-minute service test on it, all right? You don't need to go into any more detail than that because UL has their criteria for how they're going to test the pumps. You don't need to specify that the pump needs to be run for 2 hours at 100% of rated capacity at 150 PSI net pump pressure. That's already listed in the UL criteria, and is a large portion of that is incorporated into by reference the NFPA, the 1901 document. All right, the NFPA standard requires that all cabs be custom cabs be crash tested. The standard that exists, as I stated, is a European standard, been adapted into the United States, and now it's not an option. You know, for a while, there were custom cab people that had their cabs tested, and some that didn't, and they used that as a specification advantage. And I guess just to wrap up, going back, you want to be fair in the process. If you're looking to buy just one brand of apparatus, no matter who makes it, then frankly, don't be surprised if that's the only vendor you met with, all right, and you wrote your spec solidly around his product, don't be surprised the day of the bid opening when you show up that Wednesday at 2 o'clock and your village clerk gives you a little smile, or in some cases a frown, and says, Chief Wilbur, we only got one bid. Don't be surprised, all right?
And what about the price of that, though? Because there's no competition in this particular...
If that vendor, you know, could that vendor take advantage of you? Potentially. I'm sure it's happened somewhere, sometime, all right? And that's why they call it competition, all right? We're looking to get the product that meets the requirements, assuming that those requirements in the bid specs were developed around the needs assessment that you did early on, all right, and that the bids are competitive. But as we found, final thought for the day, if you find out there's a $70,000 spread, even if you only got two bids back, and there's a $70,000 spread between the low bidder and the high bidder, all right, don't be surprised to find out that the low bidder, somewhere along the line, maybe isn't giving you everything that the other guy did. And whether you do it on your own, whether you go throw the bids back to the committee, whether you hire somebody like Mike and I or get some outside assistance, It's probably, if you haven't gotten help to that point, it's probably time to go do it, because chances are, unless the fire department itself controls the purse strings, you may have a difficult situation in any time in history, but certainly given today's economic climate, to go in front of your mayor and council or whomever the governing board is and just start pounding your fist on a table and say, we need the $70,000 more expensive rig because I'm the fire chief, because I say so. You know, if that ever did hold weight, probably doesn't hold a whole lot of weight now. So, Mike, we've covered an awful lot of ground. Today we're going to wrap up. Any parting thoughts?
Just a word to the wise, buyer beware. If it quacks like a duck and walks like a duck, it just might be a duck.
Well, I guess I'd rather take the duck analogy than getting another one of your famous engine slams. So, hey, for Mike Wilbur and Tom Shand, live from Firehouse Expo here in Baltimore, Maryland, overlooking Orioles Camden Yards, be good, be safe.
If you have a comment on this program, drop us a line at radio@firehouse.com. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned to firehouse.com for more broadcasts like these. Or visit our website at www.firehouse.com/radio.